solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to the next episode of Connecting the Dots. And sorry for the long radio silence of the podcast over the last few weeks. We were busy launching the modified version of the podcast website that further enhances the experience of the listeners. Our powerful search functionality, curated nuggets, ability to create your own playlist, a growth-minded community, and much more. Do check it out at playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. In this episode, we're going to be connecting the dots on parenting. While we get degrees in engineering, commerce, arts, science, law, and so on, most of us are winging parenting as we go through life. When I speak to each of my guests, we often spend time talking about their journey, their formative years, and very often it yields an insight or two about parenting. While there's no magic answer, I try to distill a few pieces of wisdom that have stayed with me in the context of parenting and helping our children play to their full potential. I hope you will find this meaningful. This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. I'm based in Mumbai. My mission is to help growth-minded leaders play to their unique potential. When I'm not podcasting, I work as an executive coach and as a sounding board to leaders. However, I realize that my bandwidth is finite and there are only so many people I can work with. Hopefully, this content that I'm creating can make a difference to a wider set of people who are keen to play to their full potential. A quick request if you're seeing value in the podcast. Please take a moment and rate and review the show on Apple or Spotify and hit subscribe to be notified when a new episode comes out. Let's now dive into the topic for this episode, parenting. For you to get a sense of where I'm coming from, I should tell you that I have two young children, 14-year-old girl and a 10-year-old boy. Before we dive in, I should also share that this is work in progress for me and I want you to see me as a curator of insights, not necessarily an expert in parenting. Before we move to what we do with our children, I feel parenting is as much about us, the parents, than them, the children. I'd like to lay out three themes about how we handle ourselves before we bring children into the picture. First is how we think about identity. Second is how we think about time. And the third is how we prioritize various items in front of us. Let's start with how we think about identity. If being an effective parent does not figure in the list of identities we are intentional about, then nothing else that I say in the rest of the episode is going to matter. Let me suggest a small exercise that might help you here, something I discussed in the Connecting the Dots episode on identities. In some of the clients I work with, I often get them to reflect on the identities they care about. The exercise requires you to find a quiet spot for half a day or a full day where you're not distracted and you don't have any devices pinging or disturbing you. Imagine yourself 5 years out. Not 10 years, it's too far out. Not 1 year, it's too close. 5 years. First, you think of the various identities that matter to you. For each of the identities, try and find an adjective for that. For instance, caring parent, loving spouse, competitive long-distance runner, ambitious professional, and so on. You get the drift. One identity and one additional word which qualifies the kind of person you want to be
in that domain of your life 5 years down the line. Write down the list of 5 to 10 identities that you care about in one page. Don't rush this. Take your time. Once you're done with this, write down each of these two word combinations in a separate page. If you had 10 identities, take 10 sheets of paper and write the two words on the top of each sheet of paper. For instance, one page would have caring parent, another page would have loving spouse, another page would have ambitious professional, and so on. Now take each page and ask yourself why multiple times. Why is that important to you? Stay with one page for a few minutes, as long as it takes. The idea is not to rush the process. And this process is like going down an iceberg. Initially, you will discover some feelings and emotions you have around that identity. As you ask why and go deeper, you will find that you unearth your values and beliefs. As you go deeper, you're likely to find some basic needs you're trying to meet or fears you're trying to avoid. There's no right answer here. The idea is to just stay with the page and go as deep as you can till you get a sense that you've gotten to the bottom of the iceberg. You then move to the next page and continue this exercise and go down the bottom of the iceberg and so on till you complete all the pages.
When I did this exercise recently, one of the things I wrote down was to be a nurturing parent. Why? I felt if I had to stay true to the mission of helping people play to potential, I had to start my work at home, and setting a nurturing climate was a prerequisite for this. I also wanted the children to grow up with a sense of emotional security. Why? It's a messy, complex world, and there's a chance of kids getting into a negative whirlpool if things don't go per plan for them. Why? Given the proliferation of devices, social media, comparisons and uncertainties in careers and pathways, I felt they could end up being unhappy and have mental health issues. When I asked another why, I felt happiness is something I wished for in the kids and felt that success or accomplishment without inner happiness is hollow. You get the broad drift. When we do this exercise, we have a sense of why we care about the various identities, and that gives us some sort of steer on how we think about our marginal unit of time and attention as we deal with the rough and tumble of life. So the first point I want to make in this episode is that we all need to give meaningful weightage to parenting as an identity before we move forward. The second insight I want to share with you is in the way we think about time, especially opportunity cost of time. This is specifically relevant for people in advisory services where they bill per unit of time. And this would include management consultants, lawyers, doctors, accountants, and many others where there's a direct connect between the time spent at work and money made. And very often there's a tendency to attach a dollar value to a unit of time, and that can come in the way of how we think about parenting as compared to spending another unit of time at work. I used to fall into this trap very often, and even now have to remind myself every now and then. Professor Ashley Willens of Harvard Business School has written the book Time Smart and has studied the interplay of time and money and the implication on happiness. She speaks about how some of these professions can distort our relationship with time.
We've already been talking about, in the course of this conversation, we are very good at prioritizing money as opposed to free time, and we tend to make our decisions more with our finances in mind. And this is even more true for individuals who bill by the hour, consultants, lawyers, contract workers who mm-hmm. know the economic value of their time. There's been some great research by Stanford DeVoe and Jeff Pfeiffer at UCLA and Stanford respectively, and I have a paper on this as well, showing that once we know what our time is worth from an economic perspective, we worry about squandering it, about wasting it, about being inefficient. As a result, we make not necessarily great decisions from a happiness perspective. Even asking students to play the role of a consultant in the lab and bill their time by the hour makes students less likely to want to volunteer. They spend more hours working. They are less environmentally sustainable. In one of my studies, they were less likely to go 2 minutes out of their way to recycle because it didn't feel like a good use of their time. And this shows that this mindset of thinking about what our time is worth and seeing time as a means to make money can have negative detrimental consequences for how we allocate our time in terms of activities that we know are good for happiness. We have a forthcoming paper showing that performance incentives, to the extent that they also trigger this financial first mindset, lead employees to prioritize spending time with their colleagues as opposed to spending time or even helping their friends and family, because all of a sudden those colleagues feel instrumental for the goal of making more money. And so it's really important, I think, to understand that once we see our time as money, instead of feeling like we want to spend that time in more valuable ways, we can actually end up spending our time even more obsessed and ingrained in working and earning and engaging in that hamster wheel mentality of always trying to get more.
The other related point is that very often we end up putting work on a pedestal compared to other elements of life like parenting. I used to do that earlier as well, and even now I have to keep myself in check if I swing too far in that direction, especially when I'm in efficiency mode. I would love to share a lovely anecdote by Lloyd Reeb of the Midlife Institute. He's the author of the book From Success to Significance. And he speaks about how he engages with his granddaughters and prioritizes time spent with them as compared to spending time with a client.
So now I take a morning every week to be with our two grandbabies. One is 1 year old. She's deaf and she has hearing aids, and the other's three and she's diaper changing. Now, potty changing, I mean, Deepak, can you imagine how me with one little girl with hearing aids, I'm trying not to fall out, and one little girl I'm trying to say, now do you need to go potty so she doesn't have an accident? It's like, it's like watching a circus, but it's priceless, and I'm staying in it so that I get better at it, right? I don't think I'm ever going to regret that. Do you? Do you think I'll ever regret the time I spend with those girls?
Absolutely.
And so I find deep satisfaction in that. Now, my next hour might be with the CEO of a big company. But I'm not impressed by one over the other.
I love the simplicity with which Lloyd frames this. I'm not impressed by one over the other. Just to recap this section, I feel parenting is a lot about how we think about our identities, our time, and our priorities. Until we get a grip on this at a meta level, any micro adjustments we do on the surface is likely to be futile. Let's now speak about how we engage with the children. Right off the bat, I should mention that children pay much more attention to what we are doing and who we are being than what we are telling them. So just holding yourself accountable to that is a given. I guess most people I speak to understand that. So let's move forward from there. The first insight I want to share comes from Christopher Clary, the author of Roger Federer's biography titled The Master. He speaks about how Roger Federer's parents focused on raising a good human being, not just a great sports person.
The human was more important to them, I think, than the athlete all along. And they raised Roger to behave himself and to respect other people and to respect his workspace or his fellow, his colleagues. And I think that's all part of it as well. And yes, they watched plenty of his tennis And also Robert and Lynette were also very involved in Roger's career early in his pro career when he separated with his agents, Regis Brunet and the IMG team that I mentioned before, and began to kind of run things in-house. Mirka, who became his wife, actually was his press liaison during that period. So he used to call Mirka or text Mirka to get an interview with Roger. So things have definitely changed there. But I think Robert and Lynette in the Swiss culture, and the fact that Lynette is South African by birth, not Swiss. So there was an international kind of meeting of cultures already in the Federer household. Switzerland being a fairly international place anyway, and Basel being a city right on the border with France and Germany. Roger grew up with many different cultures kind of mixing in his own house as well as outside his front door. And I think he was very comfortable navigating in international waters after that. And a lot of that has to do with his parents exposing him to all that at a very early age.
I loved what you said. For them, raising a good human being was probably a notch higher than raising a great athlete. So I guess that sort of, in a way, explains a lot of elements of parenting.
There's a lot of good stories about I don't know all the stories about Lynette. I'm sure there are plenty of those, but Robert was the one who, you know, would sort of, when he was with his son playing tennis, because Robert and Lynette are both avid amateur tennis players who came to the game later in life. And really, their enthusiasm, I'm sure, was one of the reasons why Roger gravitated to tennis. But there's stories of Robert sort of making his son walk home from the club because he was acting up during their matches, unable to control himself, and making him take public transport back instead of giving him a ride. There's a famous story of him coming back from a junior tournament, and Roger wouldn't stop complaining in the back of the car. And this is not very 21st century, at least not in our countries for parenting, but Robert gets out of the car and buries Roger's head in the snow to cool him off and get him to stop complaining. So I think there was some tough love involved, but I think there were some clear guidelines and parameters put in place by the Federer parents. And honestly, as a professional sports writer who's covered a lot of tennis, you've seen a lot of enabling behavior from parents over the years, not just in tennis, obviously in many, many sports, and probably in many academic disciplines as well, where if a child has an exceptional talent, the parents will cut them too much slack and you end up with a better talent than you do a human. But I think the Federers, at least by all the evidence we've seen from the outside, you never know how things happen when the doors are closed, but all the evidence of Roger being in the public eye for 20 plus years, all the conversations I had for this book, I think they did a good job of producing a pretty good human too.
This is something that stayed with me. The emphasis on raising a good human, not just a good tennis player. It's fascinating how that shows up in what the child values. I was listening to Roger Federer's commencement address at Dartmouth. If you haven't seen it, I would urge you to see it. He speaks about three things in the speech. The third point he speaks about is that life is bigger than the court. It's wonderful to see when a parenting approach shows up in the way the child approaches life and makes his or her choices. The second point I want to make is about raising grounded kids with empathy. I notice this especially with kids growing up to parents who are economically in a decent spot, often living in gated community bubbles. I include my children when I say this. How to build empathy is something my wife and I wrestle with. And in this context, I'd like to share what Venkat Krishnan, founder of Give India, has to say.
No, I think easily the best examples of great parenting in that context of bringing responsible kids, etc., is people who have not bubble wrapped their kids. They've kind of applied this, what I need for myself principle to the kids as well. Mm-hmm. So, given the kids all the comforts they want, so kids do get Nike shoes and all of that kind of stuff. They don't have to go and buy a cheap canvas shoe or something like that. But also saying, but this much and no further. Mm. Limited pocket money, limited access to resources, and saying no to the child a lot of times. I think it's a very important thing that these people have done in helping the child learn that, the world is not an endless stream of resources. That is number one. The number two thing that they've done is they've all involved their children in philanthropy. So a lot of people that I've seen have been involving their kids in their giving, whether it's taking the kids along. Sometimes it's done consciously, many times it's done even unconsciously. Right. So a lot of people, when I talk to about their own giving journeys now, talk about how they saw their parents doing it as a child, right? So somebody saw their parents that postman aata tha to usko ghar ke andar bula ke chai pilate the. You know, these things, you know, Stephen Covey, again, I'm sorry, I go back to him often, is says this wonderful thing. He says, your actions are so loud, I can't hear a word you say.
Mm.
Right? I think kids are ridiculously intuitive on that. They pick on your actions, your behavior far more than, you know, any amount of preaching and storytelling that you can do. So I think that has been another very important thing where I've seen people bring up compassionate children. It's often by creating opportunities for their kids. So it could be celebrating their child's birthday with some other children in a less privileged place, you know, taking them along for the various philanthropic activities that they do, talking to the child a lot about these issues, getting the child to reflect. You know, reflection is a great, great, great tool. The more we can get people to reflect, including children, huge way to help build great, thoughtful children.
I'm reminded of an interview I saw with Jeff Bezos recently. The interviewer asks him, "You're a wealthy man. Are your kids in touch with reality?" To which Jeff narrates a conversation with his son. And Jeff says when he asked his son, "How is it going in the school? Do your classmates think that you're in touch with reality?" His son responds to him, "Dad, I'm in touch with my reality. That's the best I can do." I found that distinction to be very, very useful. For a long time, I would look at my kids through the lens of my childhood and that context, and that led to unproductive conversations, as I wasn't acknowledging their reality. I guess we have to ground them where they are, not where we were. I hope you're finding this compilation of value. If you would like curated access to some of these nuggets, my commentary on some of these themes, hand-edited transcripts, and access to a growth-minded community of individuals, consider signing up for the Play to Potential membership. You can find the details at playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. Let's get back to the topic at hand, parenting. Moving from acknowledging the child's reality, I think there's a piece around acknowledging the child's emotions as well from time to time. David Bradford, who's been teaching interpersonal skills to students at Stanford for over 40 years, has an interesting take on it.
For one thing, with kids, you don't label them. You focus on behavior, you don't label them.
Mm.
So let me give an example. When I was, I guess, 10, 12 years old, I still remember the instances. There were several times my mother said, "Well, David, the trouble is you're just lazy."
Mm.
Turned out to be a very destructive comment, because I said, that's who I am. And I said to myself, gee, if I don't work hard, I'm going to end up on the streets. And I saw myself as a lazy person had to overcome it. Well, anybody who knows me knows I'm constantly working.
Mm.
So that was a label. And when we label kids, they take it in as who they are. Now, if she would have said, you're having a hard time getting your homework done on time, that's a behavior.
Hmm.
Then we could have done something. So I think we have to be careful about labeling. The other thing is we have to legitimize their feelings.
Hmm.
So I have a story in which I'm not proud about, but I think it's very revealing. When my son was about 5 years old, he went down a slide and hit the back of his head and the edge of the slide. I was crying. I rushed over and I said, "Oh, Jeffrey, you're not hurt." And with tears running down his face, he said, "How do you know how I feel? Only I know how I feel."
Mm-hmm.
And he had me. He was right. What I should have said was, I'm upset that you're hurting. But I was delegitimizing his feelings. And we delegitimize it all the time. We say, oh, you shouldn't be angry. You shouldn't, your older sister shouldn't be mad at your older daughter, shouldn't be mad at her brother just because he's now getting more attention. Well, she's mad. She's envious. That's the way it is.
I was reading a book. Yeah, apologies. I was reading a book called Toxic Positivity, where it talks about this notion of not being present to the emotion that's emerging, but really quickly brushing it off with a positive emotion.
Yes. Yes.
You ought to be feeling this kind of thing.
Yes. What you're feeling is what you're feeling. I may not like that I'm feeling that way, but I'm feeling it. So I think as a parent, can we focus on behavior, legitimize our feelings, and can we also be open to our own feedback? Can we say, hey, am I doing something that's causing a problem?
I really found this language valuable. Legitimize the child's emotion. After I heard the nugget, I found that there were instances where I was not really acknowledging my son's emotions at different points in time. Now, moving to a different theme, the nugget that made the most impact on me and my parenting style was from Professor Raj Raghunathan, an individual who's researched happiness and has written the book, If You're So Smart, Why Aren't You Happy? When I asked him about how to raise happy kids, he had an interesting insight where he referred to the movie Sound of Music. He made the distinction between a font trap approach and a Maria approach.
So you can envision this graph in your head, one dimension, the vertical dimension being amount of love that the kids get, low to high, and the other dimension is the amount of discipline that they get, right? That are the rules in the house, and do they have to follow the rules? And if they're not followed, then they're disciplined, maybe through punishment, and maybe through other means, right? And so, again, you can imagine low versus high, okay? And these four cells that come out have actually been named, and the researcher that does a lot of work on this is, or used to do a lot of work, maybe she's not doing anymore, is a person named Baumrind, B-A-U-M-R-I-N-D. And so the high cell, right? High levels of love, high levels of discipline, that is called authoritative parenting. Okay. High levels of discipline, low levels of love, that's called authoritarian parenting. And you can think of Von Trapp, right? Was it Colonel Von Trapp? Whatever, you know, so from the
Sound of Music, of course.
So he was authoritarian, right? I mean, a lot of discipline, very little love until Maria comes into the household. Okay, and the low levels of love, low levels of authority, discipline, that's called negligent parenting, where, you know, the kid is just abandoned, basically. No love, no discipline. If you have read this short story called Junius Maltby, I think that is probably negligent. Actually, maybe that is permissive, actually. You know, that's the fourth category, which is a lot of love and no discipline, okay? And what we found is that, as far as we could tell, the discipline dimension wasn't that significant at all in our study, okay? So one of the things that we worry about is that if we don't discipline our kids when they're growing up, then they're going to end up being messed up. You know, they're not going to be able to be diligent in pursuing their passions. They're not going to put in those 10,000 hours, and they're not going to be successful. They're going to fritter it all away. And that's a big, deep worry that a lot of parents have, okay? And I'm not saying that discipline is not important, but I think it's a little bit less important than we think it is, okay? And if it comes to a compromise or a trade-off between love and discipline, I think that love should always trump. Love should always trump, okay? And sometimes what we do, and we are very good at this as human beings, is that in the garb of love, we end up passing what is actually our pet desire, right? And so for a very stark example of this, that, you know, we want our kids to really succeed in, let's say, playing the piano, right? And we give them, like, you know, very harsh, meet out harsh punishment if they end up not practicing enough. You know, we tell them that it's all for you. It's for your good because I love you that I do this. Okay, so in the garb of love, we kind of end up being martinets, strict martinets that are even willing to psychologically punish our kids so that they achieve our goals. So I would say that as a parent, I think one thing you need to do is you need to kind of step back a little bit and ask yourself, why do I want them to achieve this goal? And really be deep, like truly honest to yourself about why, right? And I think that many parents will discover that one of the reasons why they want their kids to achieve these goals is because they themselves did not achieve these goals. Okay, so it's a kind of a vicarious way of fulfilling what happens to be your pet dream. And you want to, now that you failed in achieving it, and often it's the case that these parents themselves were probably subject to a lot of discipline without love from their parents. And at that point, they reacted violently against it or passive aggressively against it. And they didn't learn to play the piano as a kid or mridangam or what have you. And now they're kind of regretting it and they wish that they had actually learned. Okay. And they kind of, you know, absorb that blame to some extent. And now they're kind of like, it's like ragging, right? I mean, you just pass it on to the next generation. Okay. There's a much, much better approach. And the approach is got to do with love, you know? So if you truly want your kids to achieve this thing, you know, you want them to achieve, great heights in piano, then why don't you learn it yourself right now? Right? Sit down with them and practice with it rather than telling them, you know what, you go and practice next 2 hours, you're going to practice. I shouldn't hear a peep from you. I should only hear you play the piano. Right. And meanwhile, you're sitting there watching a sitcom or, one of these shows, soap operas on TV. What's that message, you know, to your kid? The message is that what they care about is my achievements. Okay. And I'm only loved to the extent that I achieve things. That's not a good message to send to your kid. Okay. It's going to mess them up. So you learn it yourself. You make it creative. Maybe tell them that, look, okay, let's figure out the song, okay, the piano for the song, and we're going to sit down and I'll learn how to play the guitar or I'll sing, okay, and I want you to kind of learn the piano, okay, and play the piano parts. And sit down with them, help them out, make it a game, gamify it, have a lot of laughter, a lot of creativity, a lot of love. And that's a much better approach, much better parenting approach, okay? So it's a very big area, right? I mean, how to raise happy kids. One of the other things that I would say very quickly is transmit messages to them that nurture a sense of abundance in them rather than a scarcity mindset, okay? So if they come back from a game of cricket, okay, rather than ask them, did you win? How much runs did you score? How many wickets did you take? Let the first question be, did you have a good time? Did you enjoy yourself? Okay? Did you help other people out? Okay? If you're playing a game in which that is relevant, like assists in basketball. Okay, so those are much better questions. In fact, Adam Grant, we talked about him quite a bit, right, earlier. One of the practices that he has on a daily basis, I think, maybe weekly, but certainly weekly, if not daily basis, is to ask his children, who did you help out? Who are the three people you helped out today, right? Because he knows that helping other people out is a much more reliable determinant of success than striving for superiority over other people. And so in a similar vein, we know that abundance-minded people are not just happier, they're more successful as well. So encourage this sense of abundance, okay? Ask them if they're pursuing their passion, if they're having fun, if they're enjoying themselves, if they're helping other people out, rather than encouraging social comparisons. You know, don't ask your child, okay, how come you're not reading big books like Amy does? You know, she's already finished the Harry Potter series and here you are still reading, you know, Tintin or something. So those kinds of things, you know, in the short run, it might make the kid insecure and make them pursue, goals. But in the long run, you're really messing them up. That's not a very good strategy at all.
I found this insight from Raj really helpful, especially during COVID, where kids got an overdose of parenting because we were all in the same physical space for a prolonged period of time. My default tendency earlier would be to go down the path of discipline. But thanks to this insight from Raj, I could catch myself a few of the times I went down that path. This summer, my family and I, along with some friends and family from business school, made a trip to Austria and spent some time cycling through the streets of Salzburg. We did catch a glimpse of some of the movie sets of the movie Sound of Music. And it was a healthy reminder for me to tune into the Maria approach and not the Captain Von Trapp approach. Next, I'd like to talk about something I learned from Bruce Feiler, author of the book Life is in the Transitions. He describes a lovely term, co-narration. He speaks about the notion of how two different people might look at the same situation with different lens and how that can be of value. Very often, as a coach and a sounding board, this is a big element of what people see value in, my perspective or my take on a situation they are in. But coming back to the family, if we can find some rituals either around dinners or otherwise where we share stories and help the children co-narrate the stories, I believe it can be super powerful.
Think about your childhood dinner table, if you will, for a second, and think about how this is really the kind of breeding ground where we learn how to tell stories. Right. So what did you do today? Okay. And let's just say that you and I were brothers. I'll make you the older brother and I'll be the younger brother in this dynamic. And you and I went off to on a fishing trip and we're coming back and we're telling the other members of the family, whether it's just our parents or grandparents or siblings or whatever. And what's going to happen? What did I say? You're the older brother. I'm the younger brother here. I'm going to start telling the story. So, oh my gosh. And we threw the bait into the water and the fish came. And what are you going to do? I'm not going to be 8 words into the story before you interrupt me. And you tell me and you start correcting my story. You say, that's not what happened. I did it. No, you didn't do this. I caught the first fish. What are we doing? There's actually a kind of a geeky social science word for this. We are co-narrating this story. That's what a coach does. A coach, a friend, a mentor, a neighbor, a loved one helps you tell the story. And sometimes you're improving the story, and sometimes you're asking a question that maybe the storyteller doesn't think of. Sometimes you're reflecting a pattern back to the teller. This act of co-narration is a fundamental and beloved and critical part of being a human being, is sharing your story with others. It could be your brother or sister, could be your family, could be your colleague, could be a spouse. It could be a therapist. What does a therapist do? But in a sense, a kind of co-narration. And I think that what the coach is doing is helping you hear things in the story that you may not hear, or see things in the patterns that you may not see, and ultimately, if it works, help you a little more efficiently get to the meaning, the meaning-making part of the storytelling. Because fundamentally, a lifequake is a meaning vacuum where the kind of normal building blocks of what's important to us are stripped away. And what the life transition is restoring the meaning-making. And why any outsider is important is they can help us tell the story perhaps a little more efficiently and get to the wisdom that's there that sometimes we're not able to see.
Creating the space for these conversations to happen can build empathy and perspective in kids as they grow up with a richer set of perspectives to make sense of the world they see around them. A quick note on gender. As a father of a girl and a boy, I realize that I need to be mindful for each of them to flourish in their own way, and I shouldn't subconsciously do something that might come in the way later. In this context, there was an interesting nuance that Sally Helgeson spoke about. She's the author of the book How Women Rise, that she's co-authored with Marshall Goldsmith. When I asked her about what we can do as parents for our daughters to flourish, she brought up an interesting point about improved listening for boys and how a disproportionate quest for perfection comes in the way of women growing. She speaks about 12 traps that women fall into that come in the way of them growing. One of them is a perfection trap. And sometimes what we do at home when they are young can lead to that wiring.
I think that they can benefit by trying to help their boys be better listeners. That is an essential skill for rising together, for achieving their own best while helping women and the rest of the world achieve it as well. So I think they can emphasize listening skills to their boys, which I see often are, you know, to some extent disregarded. I think that certainly for girls, it doesn't help female children to be complimented by saying, oh, that's perfect, you did a perfect job, etc., because it gives them that idea, that mental clue, oh, this is what being good at something is. It means that I have to be perfect at it. So I think there's some really good modeling we can do. I want to share a quick little story that was from an event that I was working at a great tech company out in Silicon Valley right before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, a young woman came up to me and she said, you know, I have a thing in the book where I, you know, trying to let go of worrying and rumination. And I put up a sign in my office that says, oh, well, to remind myself to have a kind of a let it go attitude. And she said, that was the most helpful thing I read in the book. She said, and I'm a real ruminator. That's one of the behaviors in the book. She said, so I find that it's really helpful for me to put up little stickies all over my house that say, oh, well, oh, well, oh, well, to remind myself. So when things happen, I'll go, oh, well, oh, well. She said, well, I just want to tell you this. She said, a couple days ago, my 3-year-old daughter came into the kitchen and she was carrying a big bowl of Jell-O and she tripped on the door sill and the Jell-O went all over the kitchen floor. And she just looked up at me in her little 3-year-old voice and said, oh, well, she said, and it was because she'd heard me say it so many times. She said, so I felt really happy that I was, you know, modeling something for the next generation of women and raising a strong, confident young daughter who wasn't going to, you know, second guess, apologize, shrink, you know, feel terrible because she made a perfectly normal mistake and wasn't expecting herself to be perfect.
I guess creating more women leaders is as much about setting the climate for girls to grow and flourish as it is about raising boys who will grow up to be sensible men, who will do their bit to ensure that the families and the workplaces of the future are healthy and fair. Before we wrap this episode, let's look at how we as parents deal with a very different career paradigm that our children are growing in. In our times, there were some finite number of options we had to choose from: engineering, medicine, accounting, law, and a few more. You picked one stream and stayed in your lane. Clearly, our children are growing up in a world of abundance of options. And I do think in a world of abundant options, the ability to steer through the maze becomes a more critical meta skill than the ability to accelerate from 0 to 100 km/h in 10 seconds. A similar insight came up with Pramod Sinha, the chairperson of Ashoka. He spoke about the role of parents and the way they could help their children make career choices.
So if you get into a program at an IIT and you're studying metallurgical engineering, which is what I did, and you're hating it, and you can't really do anything about it.
Right, right. The switching costs are high. Right?
Switching costs are, I mean, it's zero. Infinite.
Infinite.
I mean, you cannot change.
Yep.
Right. So the point is that, you know, you not only do you get stuck, you don't have any flexibility. So this combination of choice and flexibility is really what I think is, along with this point about having breadth along with depth, is really what we need to bring into our education system to allow our young people to prepare for that world we talked about.
Got it. And if I were to make this question tactical, if I'm an individual who sort of finished my 10th, and I have the universe of options staring at me, law, commerce, finance, engineering, liberal arts, and so on. When people come and ask you the question, are there one or two questions you ask them to reflect on which will help the broad choice?
Yes, first thing I do is I ask them to listen to what their children are saying.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than deciding for them.
Hmm.
And that I see is a huge problem because, you know, I think our parents were much less concerned about what we were doing, even though at that time I think it was very important.
It was a bigger deal, possibly. Yeah. Yeah.
But today what has happened is, ironically, even with the large number of choices in careers, the choices in education are very limited still.
Interesting.
So that forces people to become very, very focused on saying, oh, I have to decide, right?
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I really ask them is, are you deciding for your kid or do they really want to study law? for example.
Yeah.
And often you will find kids who are very clear that they are very excited about being a lawyer. And if that's really what they want to do, and honestly, between you and me, objectively, they may not know.
True.
But the important part is that they are excited about it and they want to pursue it. And so, first and foremost, just clarifying that. Then, if you end up on the other side where the person doesn't know, I then start by saying, listen, it's good that you, it's okay that you don't know. There's nothing wrong with that, because otherwise people are under pressure that they are confused or they don't know.
They
and
ought
how
to know the answer. Yeah.
They ought to know, and how come they don't know, and so on. So taking that pressure off and then helping them understand that honestly, what you specialize in will not matter. In fact, this whole thing about, you know, specializing in a subject and then being in a career, and the line to that, as you know, is tenuous. It happens sometimes, but increasingly happens less and less. And so while it's important to major in something, it's not really that important to major in the right thing.
That's a good point. Right? That's a good point.
And so that kind of releases the tension of a lot of parents and children when they realize, or sometimes they don't, but most of times you can actually show the parents themselves that what they major in and what they're doing now has no connection.
I love the point Pramath makes. The link between education and professional choices has become more and more tenuous with time. I don't have to look far to understand this. My work as a coach on a sounding board has no connect with the mechanical engineering degree I have from IIT Madras. I guess that correlation is going to go down further and further as our kids grow up. That requires a very different style of parenting and letting our kids explore while having some sort of boundary conditions around it. Very often, as our children navigate the maze of life, they might have to cut losses and change course, and that requires a certain maturity on part of the parent to enable that in a constructive way. In this context, I'd like to share an insight I got from Atul Kasbekar, a celebrated photographer and producer in India. He's the man behind properties like Kingfisher Calendar and producer of movies like Neerja and Tumhari Sulu. His journey is an interesting case of an individual pivoting away from studying chemical engineering in UDCT, one of the top places in the country to study this discipline. He quit midway to go to the US to study photography and come back and build a career in a completely new space. How he decided to study chemical engineering is a fascinating story in itself. It's worth taking a detour to understand how he made the choice to study chemical engineering at UDCT.
I actually had exceptional grades in school. I was in Campion and then in Jai Hind. And I think this is, we're talking now in the 70s and early 80s. So, you know, if you had the grades, it was generally assumed at that time that you'll become one of three, four professions, you know, and primarily with engineer, doctor, CA, chartered accountant, etc. So, you know, and I was exceptionally good at chemistry. I enjoyed that subject. My dad had a chemical factory. It almost seemed logical that I'd become a chemical engineer. Now, I had the grades to get into UDCT, which is now called the ICT. At that time, the University Department of Chemical Technology, and
possibly the best chemical degree in the country.
In the country by far, rated, I think, in the top 10 in Asia as well. And, you know, so it was just one of those things that you got into UDCT, everybody was like, oh my God, you got into UDCT. So, you know, but when I got there, I realized that chemical engineering had very little to do with pure chemistry per se. You know, it had to do with, the chemical process was pretty much already known. You had to design equipment and, you know, it was more physics, and physics I hated. So all of a sudden, I realized that I was quite easily going to be the worst chemical engineer known.
I love what he says. So often, we make a transition based on a certain set of assumptions, and it turns out very different from what we anticipated. What I've come to realize in transitions is that what you think it will be and what it turns out to be are often two very different things. Some things are better said in Indian languages. Jo dikhta hai wo hai nahi, jo hai wo dikhta nahi hai. But we digress. Coming back to parenting,
It's fascinating how Atul Kasbekar's father dealt with this dissonance that he had.
They were like, you want to be a photographer, great, but what are you going to do for a living? You know, that kind of thing. But what was interesting was that, I wasn't someone who was flippant.
Yeah.
You know, and I captained my school in cricket, in the debates. I represented Maharashtra State at the Republic Day Parade, in the NCC. I was school captain. You know, I captained basketball. So it wasn't like this guy is going to chuck it all away. I mean, they would see this, he'd be fairly serious about whatever. So, so I have to say it was a very big decision for them. Hats off. And they tried all these things of, but why don't you finish the degree and then you do whatever you want to and whatever.
Right.
I'm like, why would I waste 3 years? You know, makes no sense.
Mm.
And even though, to give due, absolute due credit, even though he couldn't afford it at that time, my dad insisted that, okay, you, whatever education you want is not a problem. You figure out which is the best place in the world to go to and I'll send you there. I was like, but you can't afford it right now, you know, so, and he's saying, shut up, that's none of your business, you know, and, but this is your long rope because the education is everything. The receipt I want for it, he always had this thing about a degree.
Yep.
So I said, you know, photography, I don't really need a degree. I can assist people, I can learn, etc. I said, no. I want a degree to make myself happy. The degree is my receipt for the money I'm spending.
Very interesting.
Okay, so you give me my receipt. I don't care what you do with this.
That as a parent, I've done my best to equip you for whatever.
So it was a great line. He said, look, you know, this is your long rope. Now you come up with it or you hang yourself is up to you. Okay, but I'm giving you that long rope. And after I've taken care of your education and your sister's education, etc., your mother and I will studiously spend your inheritance, which I thought was a very cool thing. And I have that's one of the few lines I have brutally used with my kids. Kya padhna hai batao? Okay, you get that one shot of the title. After that, good luck, buddy. You know, and if you need me to make phone calls, I'm more than happy to make them. Need me to stand guarantor for something, I'm happy to do that. But, you know, I mean, it's you go on your journey now.
Got it.
And then that safety net right now, which is right under your ass, you know, for my kids, I will move that now 30 feet below and then further below and then take it away.
I guess given the multiplicity of career pathways and the number of twists and turns the kids might have to take, I like the approach of Atul's father, which drives rigor in a certain direction while giving the child the leeway to pursue the direction. This is probably a good place to wrap this episode. When it comes to parenting, I guess all of us are winging it to some extent. But some of what I've shared in this episode have helped me become a better parent. And the journey continues. I hope that you found the compilation useful. If you find this content of value, do take a moment and rate and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever else you consume the content. If you want the curated nuggets by themes like this, my commentary, transcripts, and access to a community, you can consider the membership at playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. Thank you for listening and your attention. And I look forward to having you in one of the subsequent conversations at the podcast. Bye now.